And we're live on this morning's Freedom Series podcast with special guest Andrew Miller. Andrew Miller is a startup marketer who's been traveling the world working with early stage companies for the past 15 years. After driving growth for three multi-million dollar startup exits, including 500 startups projects in San Fran, he became a full-time growth consultant via his company Growth Experts, focusing on helping companies scale efficiently in the early stages with both growth coaching and remote consulting. He also has bootstrapped startup coaching programs where he helps pre-funding startups to get traction with an online course and private coaching. He's written for Inc. magazine, Startup Grind, and Startup Nation. Andrew is also a prolific digital nomad who in the last decade has visited, lived, and worked from 70 countries around the world. Dude, COVID must be kicking your ass.
I love it. No. I mean, obviously, it was a shock in the beginning to most people. It was less to me because I've been working remotely from home for a while. But this is the most time I've ever spent with family since 2003. So yeah. There's a lot of silver linings there. But yeah, I mean, I think I might have graduated out from the travel bug and now I'm ready to settle down. I think this has caused, you know, but I was never really like backpacking. So a lot of people think, oh, digital nomad means like, you know, you're living out of a bag and you're going. I was always, you know, 1 to 3 months in each place to settle down and focus mostly on the work. So I'm doing fine.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. It's interesting how like certain situations in life cause us to go through these transitional phases. Where did, I guess, entrepreneurship start for you, mate? Like you've been about for a while, you've worked with a ton of companies, you've had some amazing successes. Like where did this all start for you?
Well, I had an auto detailing company when I was 16. I mean, that's too far back. But no, but really, even before I was hireable, I started my own thing and I was cleaning cars for $100. I mean, like really cleaning them like meticulously. And I realized, wow, it's easier to make money on your own than to be fit into someone else's environment. In college, I had a video resume or video CV startup where we sold CVs, video CVs to graduating college students. That went well. But I graduated with an international business degree and I moved out of the country. And so I worked with various startups around the world on a full-time basis that way and only became a consultant and an entrepreneur who was building my own business, helping other people's businesses in the last 5 years after three successful exits. So I worked full-time individually for companies. They exited, made them millions of dollars and realized, you know what? I shouldn't put all my eggs in one basket. I would love to work on multiple projects. And that's kind of where the entrepreneurial effort was born. And now since in the last 5 years, we've probably worked on 25 companies instead of, you know, one at a time.
Yeah. Amazing. I want to deep dive on that. Before I do, I just want to welcome the guests that are watching this, whether it be live now that we're streaming across multiple platforms on the interwebs or whether it be a replay. If you are watching live, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Please feel free to put your comments and questions below. Hit the like button and my team will, who's tracking all the different comments, will feed them through and we'll get your questions answered. If you are watching this on a replay, just do hashtag replay to allow us to ask your questions and we'll be sure to get them answered as well. So working with startup companies versus businesses that are more established, would you say there's a significant difference in the way in your approach of how you'd coach them, how you'd work with them, the kind of strategy you implement?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm specifically very passionate about early stage startups. So literally like the very first time they've ever considered marketing, they're like, what the hell do we do, Andrew? I do two major things. I work with pre-funding companies in my coaching and marketing advisor program where I help them build the strategy, figure out what their analytics need to look like, you know, and drive their initial traction to go raise funding. And then I have another company where we focus on helping funded companies do their initial marketing and scale up once they've got budgets. And with those two projects, obviously they're very different, but the one problem remains the same. You know, we are usually working with tech founders. They don't really understand marketing. They expect the product to do all the marketing for them. We're going to launch this and it's going to be amazing. We're going to be wild famous. And you're actually doing yourself a disservice not prioritizing marketing earlier on. So I teach early stage founders how to prioritize marketing early on, even before you have a ton of money to spend on paid ads. What can you do to start garnering some traction before? With established companies, they already have spent some money. They know what works. You know, they just need someone to manage the execution of it. And we do that as well. I have worked maybe 5 or 6 times with like billion-dollar companies on starting their new side projects. I worked with Tinder on launching a new dating app for them. We worked with BBVA Bank in Europe on launching a fintech side project for them. And those budgets are obviously way different. And I think, you know, if you're out there listening and you're trying to figure out a marketing strategy for your business, the easiest thing to try and figure out is, you know, do you have more time or more money? And you, if you have more time to grow and you don't have a lot of money, then you focus a lot on those organic strategies and, you know, your growth hacking, your PR, your content, your social media, whatever it may be. And if you're one of those really larger, more established companies, you have less time and more money. And so you throw money at the problem and you try to grow more through paid user acquisition. And so that's the biggest difference, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting that you brought that up. We have a tool that we use with our clients called the Opportunity Evaluator. And I actually, funny enough, have included the book. I haven't spoken about it in any lives so far, but it's just that, is that I see often entrepreneurs, they don't necessarily have a good decision-making matrix around how am I investing my time, my money, my team, my resources. They make decisions on the fly. It's like, oh, like someone said, go on, get a ClickFunnels account and build a funnel and like throw some paid traffic in. And so they go down that path and wonder why it doesn't convert or doesn't do what it can. But the Opportunity Evaluator does just that, like we spoke about, it is like, okay, as entrepreneurs, one thing we're never short of is ideas. So going through and dumping down all these ideas that come from us or that we've heard from others, and then going through and working out, okay, like how much time would it cost me to execute this strategy? And how much do I value my time at? Is it $50 an hour, $100 an hour, $1,000 an hour? You know, how much money do I have to put into this in terms of maybe commissions or, you know, ad spend or whatever the case may be, and work out what the cost is for the opportunity, but then also create an assumption of what should my return be? Now, although we never really know, like we never really know in launch of these strategies what our return's going to be, the reality is when we're going through it and filtering these, we're coming from the same mindset. So however slanted we are, whether we're way too optimistic or way too pessimistic, we're going to be way too optimistic on all of them or way too pessimistic on all of them. And what we find is when we go through and do that and you report back after you've gone, okay, well, I've got a bunch of time but no money. So which strategy do I perceive is going to give me the greatest yield based on having time, having no money? Put it in place, come back and report your results. You actually start to condition and train your mind to be more strategic in its thinking on the fly rather than how we kind of first start off in business, which is like, oh, like I think I should just run a funnel or, hey, I just think I'm going to just do some blog posts. When it's like, do you know how long it takes to get traction on blog posts or an SEO versus going and doing maybe a joint venture strategy or something like that?
Right. No, yeah. And I think people get like a paradox of choice and an opportunity paralysis as CEO, your chief everything officer. And whenever I do my in-person seminars, hopefully those start up soon again. The one thing that people say afterwards is, holy crap, Andrew, with a ton of information, what do we do first if we're, you know, working on product and working on HR, working on raising funding, you know? And I tell them to figure out what's the lowest hanging fruit for their business and then start executing that. Like what needs no other outside help from you, and just focus on one major marketing thing per day. But yeah, I mean, you have to really figure out what's going to have that return on time investment. And you mentioned that, you know, when a lot of early stage businesses, when they're not spending money, they're spending their time very frivolously. And I teach them and train them to start thinking about their time like their money, because that's actually the more scarce resource that you'll ever have. You know, you and Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos have the same amount of time in the day, but he's got way more money. So, you know, you have that resource is more finite. And so spending your time wisely in the beginning will lead you to a better result.
Yeah. This is where I feel that mindset is so important. Like I look at how I view business right now, and it is so different to when I started like 18 years ago, you know, in terms of that and how protective I am of my time, or, you know, how I filter in opportunities. Like I remember very early on, I see this a lot. You go to networking events, you're like, oh, hey, like what are you doing? Like, they're like, oh, I've got 10 companies. And you're like, oh shit. I can guarantee you that probably none of them are successful right now. If you know, you've been an entrepreneur for 12 months, you've got 10 companies, you know, because you haven't yet learned how to invest your time moving forward. So how could someone who's an early stage business, I guess, gain greater traction faster? You know, there's a million competing priorities. There's not often a lot of money in the bank. There's great ideas coming through. Like, what are some advice or some tips if there is people watching right now that is earlier in their stage to get their business up and running faster?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's no one blanket strategy that I think anyone can lean on. It really depends on your target demographic. What is the conversion? You know, what are you asking them to do? What is the value you're creating for them? But, you know, if you really drill it down, the easiest first thing you can do is figure out who is your absolute target demographic. That's what I say, like the absolute perfect person where you create the most value for them. and then find out where they are online and start engaging with them. You know, so if you don't have any money, then you invest 1 hour a day in direct outreach to those people. And that's going to drive you a lot of user feedback very quickly, you know, so that be it in social media and email outreach, one way or the other, it's only costing you your time and you're getting yourself right in front of the people who are absolutely going to find value in the message that you're sending. That is the secret to sales and marketing overall, is not thinking about what can I get from these people. It's, you know, who are the people that I'm going to help the most and how can I create the most value for them? So starting there, figuring out the reverse engineering, what channels I need to focus on from there. So if it's, you know, doing a huge online giveaway, or, you know, that's how I'm going to create the most value for people. Or if it's, you know, we have this incredible story, we need to get it out. If you objectively know that it's a really powerful story, it's creating value for the reporters, then you start with a PR strategy. If you just have to make up a story that's not that interesting and not related to what's going on in the world right now, it's not creating enough value. So you're facing an uphill battle. But so if I had a new business day one and I haven't even proved the concept out yet and I don't know if people are going to really like it, I'm going to go straight to social media and email marketing, and I'm going to lean on spending the time to put it in front of people who I know are going to be really interested. You know, get 100 no's and figure out what those people don't like, and then go back and iterate on it and figure out what, and get better, and then go do it again. And the reason I say you're going to get 100 no's is almost never is the first iteration after the idea the exact product, you know? Yeah. Instagram started as a bourbon reviewing app. So then they put it out there in the world and they realized that people hated the app except for the photo filters. And that's when they stripped it down and became Instagram. So there's a million examples of that, but you have to be ready to take that bad feedback, that negative feedback, and be not emotional about it and iterate based on that feedback and continuously iterate and know that this is a 7 to 10 year process. It's not like, 1 year, we're going to sell this business. You know, that never works. If you're starting something to try and make money right away, you're going to fail. If you're starting something to solve a problem and help people, you're going to succeed as long as you never give up. So the same thing goes with marketing, right? So it's, you're trying different things, you're throwing spaghetti at the wall, seeing what sticks, but not being married to one thing. You've got to continuously innovate and try new tests with your marketing the same way with your product.
Yeah, I love that. And that's exactly how you're going to succeed in any market. If you're watching this online live right now, start a watch party. I think that was fantastic what you shared there. More people need to hear that message as well, Andrew. And if you've got any comments, questions, please put them below. So you said a couple of things there. So I read a quote once from the founder of LinkedIn that said that if you're not embarrassed by your first launch, you launch too late. And this is where I can often see that this fixed mindset that entrepreneurs have. It's like, oh, no, like I'm a good tradesperson. I'm good at fixing pipes, so I'm just going to be a plumber. And they try to go and be a general plumber for everyone and wonder why, you know, they get priced out of jobs or there's a lot of competition and so forth because they're not niche specific. But also too, this is why I saw so many of our clients succeed over the past 6 months. Like, we had massive bushfires at the start of the year here in Australia, the biggest bushfire I think the world's ever seen, which affected a lot of businesses, a lot of people. Absolutely. No sooner did the bushfires finish up, COVID hit. So off the back into COVID. Yet I saw so many of our clients succeed because of what you've just said there. And that is, like, regardless of whatever the market condition is, people are still spending money. That's the nature of us being human. Like, there's supply and demand, and we're always going to be spending money, right? Even in lockdown, we had access to the interwebs, people were still delivering parcels. Granted, they might have been a bit slower than normal, but people were spending money. And the entrepreneurs that innovated and went, hang on, this is not a pandemic. This is not a global financial crisis. This is a marketing problem. I've just got to ask, like, what are the conversations that my market's having inside their head? Or what conversations are people having inside their head right now that have got problems that aren't being resolved by the current products and services that are out there? And absolutely. So the business owners that held on to what they knew that worked, it's like, oh, but like a month ago, like I was having the biggest month I've ever had. You know, like those that held on to that were the ones that suffered. Right. And maybe they wrote it through, maybe they wrote it the other side. But the other ones were quick to go, hang on, like, we've got to innovate right now. We can't open our restaurant. We can't open our gyms. We can't run our yoga studio. Like what can we do? What need does our market still have, even though they're locked up at home, to change their messaging, to change their offer, change the way they deliver things, were the ones that have come out the other side. Like, we've seen clients that have innovated a new product during COVID that's been successful, come out the other side where things are back to normal, and now they have this whole new revenue stream they never had before, on top of their business and have actually done better as a result of it.
Yeah, I think there's a massive silver lining, and you just have to really be conscious about focusing on the value first. And I think that's like the biggest message in any of my public speaking or anything is the secret to business is focusing on how you can create more value than your competitors. And it's the same in marketing. You know, if I can identify communities that I can create value for, and the value is very present in my marketing and they can understand it, then it's going to work. That's it. So it's the same. I mean, I totally agree with you. I think there's two types of people, the curl up in the ball and get really sad and depressed. And then the other people that just spring into action and recognize that this is the biggest transition we'll ever live through probably in our lifetimes. And that's leaving lots of gaps and holes and places for people to jump in and innovate in a brand new way and really make not just a lot of money, but a lot of impact as well.
Yeah. There's something else you said. There was so much in that last part. I was trying to like remember them all. There was something that you mentioned that triggered me around like mindset and around the way that you enter these conversations. It wasn't this exactly, you might remember what it was, but it's basically like those that have the ability to lean into failure and those that have the ability to realize that failure is part of the journey, like, you know, Ryan Holiday, obstacles away, will be the ones that succeed. You mentioned something around that, like go out there, get 100 no's, no one's going to fail first time around. And I see that as being such a shortfall as well, is that you have these entrepreneurs that kind of strike it lucky. They become accidental business owners, and we meet a lot of them. They grow a business to $500,000 on referral only, and then it dries up. And then they come to us going, like, my business was going so well and it broke. But they never really had a business in the first place. Mm-hmm. They just had a lucky streak, so to speak, but they didn't have a lot of processes and systems and strategies in place for sustainable growth. But then you get the others as well, that it's like they like the idea of like being sold in the freedompreneur movement. Like, I'm going to work from my laptop anywhere in the world and, you know, make $100,000 a day while I sleep. You know, like, you get there. But what I love that you said was realistically is it's like it's a 7 to 10 year venture. You know, like, I think that there's a huge misconception that I can go into business in 12 months, be good, or be earning a good income, have the freedom. Now, you might strike it lucky and in 12 months' time be earning more than you were as an employee and have a bit more time, but it doesn't stop there. Like, it doesn't stop until, like, I believe until you have a business that's profitable and that can run without you. Like, I think when you get to that stage and you've replicated yourself through hiring a COO or a general manager or someone, that's when you hit entrepreneurship. Because then you have the ability, like, you've created a proven model. You can copy and paste into other industries and start to, I guess, divest your assets rather than being consumed, being on the tools.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, I think there are plenty of people that do hit it big really quickly. I mean, but they're usually seasoned entrepreneurs. It very rarely happens the first time. I launched a SaaS startup for a serial entrepreneur in November, and he was profitable within 1 month. And now it's been 8 months and he's doing $250,000 a month. But his first business took 6 years to get where his second business took 1 month. And I think it was because of the learnings from the first business. So he doesn't say that it took me 1 month to build the second business. It took 6 years and 1 month to build that business because the 6 years before then was the education, which enabled him to scale up that business the second time much quicker. But yeah, I mean, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You have to be really obsessed with the value in those no's. So I moved from Dubai, where I started my marketing career, I'm from America, but I moved to Dubai to work with startups. And then I moved back to San Francisco. And there's a reason why 70% of all the tech investment in the world happens in that area. It's because we have a real culture for loving failure. People around the world feel really bad when their CV has like 1 year jumps from company to company. We love that shit in San Francisco because that means more experience. It doesn't mean you were bad to work with. The most talented people might be bad to work with. It just means you have more experience. And, you know, every company that you didn't stay long term at, you got better at realizing what you needed to work on and what you look for in a team. And so we look for that as experience. Same thing with the founder. You know, if you have someone with entrepreneurial background coming in to try and work with me, I think that's a great thing, even if the company failed. My biggest failure as a startup marketer, we launched the Yelp of the Middle East, and we scaled it to 600,000 monthly uniques, and we've ended up failing. And it was a massive learning for me, and I won't get into that story too much unless you want to, but I show that proudly and talk about that proudly when I work with clients. Yes, I had a failure. If you get a marketing person coming in to try and pitch you, and he says he's never had a, or she says they've never had a failure, then they never learned anything, you know?
Run a mile.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really important to recognize there's no such thing as failure. That's what we say. There's only winning and learning. And with every time you learn, you're getting closer to winning. So if you never give up, you just keep getting closer and closer. And it's almost a guarantee at that point. It will happen at some point.
Yeah, it's I want to kind of use an analogy of surfing in a second. Like, I remember my first company, I think it took four years to get to $1 million. And then we doubled it. And then I ended up bankrupting. Yeah, long story short, I had a partner, had a couple of children. She left because she couldn't do the lifestyle. Like, I was working so much. And when I wasn't working, I wasn't present. And she left, went the other side of the country. And I didn't have a business. I had a multi-million dollar job. And like, I would step out for lunch. My phone would ring 30 times, like in the space of going out to get lunch, because I'd built an organization that relied on me being the linchpin. Now, although it was a great business, and most of that growth was organic because we were amazing at what we were doing, I learned a shitload of lessons out of that. But then when I went into my next business, it's like I did $1 million in 6 months. You know what I mean? And wow, could do that again like that, because as you said, you break through that stuff, you learn it. Now, getting back to surfing, like, I started learning to surf at the start of the year. Now, initially, like, you've got to learn like where to go on the board and how to paddle for waves and all that sort of stuff. I came back to Perth here. The waves here are so different. Like, they reckon some of the hardest waves in the world to surf because they come in super fast. They're super, super steep. But the thing that I noticed is it's like, because I knew those elements already of surfing, I could pick up the structure of the way to change, i.e. different business, different model, different service, different product.
Right.
But I still knew how to surf. I still knew the basics. So it's just a matter of getting out there and knowing if I stay here long enough and paddle for enough waves, I'm going to catch one. And once I've caught that first one, and get a feeling of how that feels like to stand up on it,
your confidence goes up.
Back out again and again. I think that, like, I just can't emphasize that enough. I see business owners that opt out too early, or they're like, you know what, like, I'm okay, I'll just do it on my own. And it's like, why the fuck would you do it on your own when you've got people that have been around you that have done it like 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times over and over and over again? Just pay them and learn from them. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Learn from them and speed up that cycle of growth. Because even if you think you're doing okay now, that's often when the blind spots hit too, right? It's like, oh, like, my shit doesn't stink, like, I'm doing well. And then bang, you know, COVID comes or something comes and you get knocked down because you weren't prepared for what was going on. A bunch of questions coming in here, which I'm going to get to in just a second. Please, if you're watching this live, welcome. Hit the like button. Let us know you're there and put your questions below. Yeah, so that's, I guess, the surfing thing. Like, you're so right. Like, once you've done it, you've kind of been there. You've broken through the thresholds, I think, mentally, emotionally, and physically as well.
Definitely.
So, Greg from Sydney, I'm into social media marketing. Can Andrew say the pandemic really exposed fake influencers? How does he sniff out fake influencers anyway?
Fake influencers. So I'm not really sure what he means by fake influencers, but overall, influencer marketing has really grown. I think way long before COVID, it started exploding and people realizing the phoniness of it, I think what he means. But for me, you know, so the first thing, Greg from Sydney, is to focus on micro influencers. The larger the audience does not necessarily mean the more value you will get from working with them. I've had the most success in building a scalable group of micro influencers. So under 5,000 followers, the percentage of engagement is much higher. And if you have 20 of them, you know, that's still 100,000 followers, but with much higher engagement. So I think what he meant was, you know, the people with millions and millions of followers, you know, the rate cards are astronomical. They're asking for thousands of dollars a post. Very unlikely that you're going to get a return on investment from that. But it's better to limp into influencer marketing or any marketing strategy. Start it for free by leveraging what you do have. If you're a business that can give the influencer free stuff, you know, give that to a couple people that have, you know, under 10,000 followers. Usually about that rate, they'll take free swag in exchange. Yeah. Get them to do some posts, create some content, prove out that it works, and then, you know, go to larger influencers after that. But you need to have at least 3-5% engagement from their total audience, or it's not worth even a dollar working with them. So
likes don't pay the bills. Engagement is where it's at.
You need click-throughs, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Jim from Sydney, could you share some case studies with some unconventional tactics, like minimal spending on ads, minimal coding? Was he able to scale rapidly? So yeah, if you've got a couple.
What was that person's name?
Jim.
Jim, love that question. You are talking to the right guy. That's what I do, baby. I mean, even when we have really big budgets, I'm always on the side working with the development team, trying to figure out slightly unethical ways that we can grow the business. You know, before it was called growth hacking, I called it aggressive online marketing. And I really benefit being the devil on the shoulder of the founders I work with. They're the protective person who wants to make sure that we don't get any bad press. And I'm like, yo, if we dye this fountain pink, then everyone in the city will know about this. You know, so I've done a lot of stuff. I think what he's specifically asking about, that's not a lie. That happened.
I got that.
I'll get to that story later. We didn't get sued, though. It was a cease and desist letter. But that's the truth. Across the board, 99% of the time, the worst thing that's going to happen to you is you're going to get a cease and desist letter, and you can do PR around that. Like, you know, so I'll tell some other non-Andrew examples. But one thing I think he was specifically talking about, like actual tech growth hacks they've done. And the first one that popped into my head was when I was still back in Dubai, long before San Francisco, I joined a classified startup. And they were already growing pretty decent, but only in that one area. And they wanted to scale eventually to other cities and through the region. And we did a ton of, you know, stuff. We did have small budgets. So I did paid search. We did SEO. We did a lot of events and partnerships. But on Fridays, I would sit with the dev team. And I wasn't very technical at the time. I definitely know a lot more. This is 10 years ago or something. But I was constantly sitting with the developers to throw out ideas for things that we could do together. Market engineering as marketing was also not a topic at the time. And, you know, it was unheard of for marketing to sit next to developers at that time. You know, they were literally on a different floor. This was a small company, like 10 people, and they were on their own floor. They didn't want to hear anything from the marketing and sales team. But I'd go up there on Friday and then have a beer. And I'd be like, hey, what if we did this? What if we did this? What if we did this? And they'd be like, you're stupid. That's a dumb idea. You don't understand tech. You don't understand engineering. And then one day I was like, what if you guys made a script that grabbed all the mobile numbers from all the classified ads in the whole region? And then we bulk SMS them from provider as my phone number and telling them to use our service. And they're like, that's stupid. Wait, we can totally build that. Let's see. And then they literally did a hackathon for like 12 hours straight in the office all Friday night, why I sat in the corner drinking by myself and just saying that I was smart or whatever. No, but I sat there and we worked with them and we built this script. And by Monday, we had 60,000 mobile numbers for free of people categorized by the thing that they were posting online. And we had a superior service to anyone else in the market. So when you have that confidence, that's when you can really do this growth hacking. It's like, we just like I said at the beginning, it's like, how can we get this value in front of these people? It's at any means necessary. When you know that you're really helping people and you Absolutely. Have, I mean, there was scams rampant from Nigerian scammers. We were the first classified site to insist on having a local mobile number. You know, there was CAPTCHA, all that stuff way before anybody else. So we had a way superior product that was going to save them from getting ripped off, was going to help them sell their house or find their job or, you know, sell their car. And we literally started bulk SMSing people through the government. It's legal in Dubai, or at least it was. And we changed lives from day one. My phone would literally shut down when we'd send out a thing. People would be like, oh my God, I got a job. I owe you so much. I was trying for 3 months. I couldn't get a job. Or, you know, I sold my house and now I have enough money to send my kids to college. Thank you so much. Blah, blah. People took me out. They texted me back. I never told them I worked for the company. It was just, the message was really simple. Hey, I saw your job online, or I saw your house online. X would drop in. I saw your X online. This site's way better. You should check it out. Link. And obviously the conversion rates are massive. And 2 months later, we sold the company for $140 million. And wow. So not just because of that, but that was a major win, because we obliterated all the competition, because as soon as they saw our product, they knew that this was a way better place for them. And we had an unbelievable email marketing, and the back end, you know, kept them involved and brought them back to the site. And, you know, so we had all the other aspects. We just needed to really get it out to people. So when you have that confidence, you can do a lot of really aggressive growth hacking stuff. Yeah, tons of examples and ideas like that. When we launched that Yelp copy that failed, one of the biggest things we did was partnerships. So growth hacking partnerships from zero, really focusing on what value can we offer for partners. So if you're listening to this and you don't have an engineering team and you're like, well, that's a really cool example, but we don't have someone who's going to build a fucking script for us that's going to rip mobile numbers. Anybody can growth hack partnerships, right? There's really two types of growth hack. And I know this is only one answer, but Jim hit me right where it counts. Like, that's near and dear to my heart. There's growth hacking your product, which you need someone who knows something about product development. But that usually looks like trying to identify all the points in the customer lifecycle and find out where they're happiest and inject with them an opportunity to share and make it viral. That is the easiest way to growth hack your product. And then on the other side, it's hacking existing channels. So how can we get into places where our target demographic are spending time or get in front of them for free at scale? And a lot of times that's partnerships. When I was at that Yelp copy, we partnered with Rihanna, we partnered with Groupon, and it was all about giving them the review data that we have. It wasn't about getting access to them. I mean, secretly in the office, we're like, we're going to get access or whatever. But it's, you know, when you think about how can you get the value that you have to offer out to those communities, then like partnerships becomes a lot easier. And I think that that's an easy thing that anyone can start hacking right away.
Amazing. Amazing. Marketing 101. I love the growth hacking topic. And it reminds me back one of the early episodes of the Comeback Game podcast I recorded with a guy called Jared Codling, who's a growth hacker. And his team worked out a way, you know, like when you apply for a local location in Google, they will send you out a calling card with a code, and that verifies that you live there. You jump back in, you enter the code, and it's like, oh, now the Game Changers head office is based in this location. Yeah. They worked out a way to hack the system to where they didn't need to get a physical code sent to the location. They did it for their initial business, which was he partnered up, I think it started with a dentistry in the States. And so all of a sudden this dentistry showed these locations everywhere in the States that basically was about acquiring traffic. But then they ended up turning into a sellable service. And within 2 months of launching, we're doing multiple six figures a month to companies that were wanting to basically expand their reach organically on Google. And the strategy was amazing. They eventually got shut down by Google. But there are so many different opportunities like this, as you said, where you can just sit there and think outside of the box that a lot of people tend to follow. I guess that's at the core of entrepreneurship as well, right? Is innovation. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, like I said, it all stems from that confidence that you're helping people. I was unethically grabbing mobile numbers off of other sites, but to help those people to stay away from those dangerous websites where they were posting their mobile number in the first place, you know, and it worked. Our site was much more secure and we were literally helping people. So if you get that change in your mindset, like you mentioned, to where like, how can I help more people with this service? And if you're listening to this and your business isn't helping people, then you're probably working on the wrong business because, you know, it's just much easier and much more obvious or comfortable to put in 14-hour workdays when you're driven by passion and you're helping people. And I think that makes the whole job way easier. But we got more questions.
Yeah, one more here from Greg. So he's curious to know what your thought of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is, being in the
random
tech space.
Yeah, so but random, but I do have a lot to talk about that as well. I was lucky enough to be in San Francisco in 2014 and share an office with someone who's doing a very, very early Bitcoin startup. And he was just preaching Bitcoin, 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 and it was at $400. And I was like, fuck it, I'll put $5,000 in. He's a millionaire. He bought it at 1 cent when he was a cryptocurrency PhD paper writer. He bought like 1,000 coins at a penny in Brazil when he was writing his dissertation. And then it went up to 500 or 700 and he made millions of dollars. And so I was like, he was like advocating in 2014 that it's going to be 10,000. You guys are crazy. Get in, get in. And so I was like, all right, I'll put a little bit of money in it. And it didn't do anything for 2 years, literally nothing. It didn't even go up and down anything. And meanwhile, you know, stock market's going up, things are doing. So that's a loss to me. Then one day it shoots up to $1,200 and I sold everything. I thought I was the most brilliant man in the world. I was like, I just made $10,000 from nothing.
Then it went to $30,000.
1 month later, one month later, I would have had $240,000, I think, or something like that from the initial $5,000 investment. And what's funnier than that is everybody had sold at $1,200. Everyone that didn't forget their fucking login and password. So, but I took that $10,000 and I put it into Litecoin at $30, and then sold at like $100. So I did end up doing pretty well. I still hold a lot of Litecoin. I think that crypto is still nowhere near even seeing the tip of the iceberg. It'll probably be the only currency we use as a planet in 50 or 100 years. And once we realize that governments have too much control or whatever, this is going way away from startups. But yeah, for me personally, I don't work with cryptocurrency businesses. Blockchain is a different thing, but I think that the market's not stable enough and there's just not a lot of value for them to create for people yet. So for me personally, I'm really focused on working with B2B and B2C startups. I'm definitely industry agnostic, but when a cryptocurrency founder reaches out to me, you know, if they're pre-revenue, I'm likely to be like, I would love to help you, but I'm not going to take cryptocurrency as payment at this time. So from a business standpoint, I look at it as just like cannabis. It's an amazing industry, plenty of room for you to get massively rich, Greg. But I think that you're just adding on layers of risk that you don't really need right now. If you don't have any other substantial business that's paying your bills, I wouldn't do that first. I would do that as a side hobby, hoping that, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, it's really big.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. We've got time for one more question here.
Someone's
written in and wants to know about the Pink Fountain.
Yeah. So it was back when we were launching a dating app for Tinder. I think I mentioned it a little bit ago. And, you know, I think that any successful marketing campaign is a lot more than just digital, especially if you're focusing on one geographic location. Even if you're launching in 5 or 10 cities, you should have some physical operations going on. For a college-focused product, obviously, we had campus marketing ambassadors that I was managing, as well as everything from PR and podcasts and paid advertising and content marketing, et cetera. But these campus intern ambassadors, you know, I was coaching them with much the same talk we've been doing today. I got them really fucking riled up to do aggressive growth hacking stuff. And they were supposed to bring all the ideas to me first, but on a weekend, they found some pink solution that they could dye. I think this was UCLA, I believe. And they dyed the fountain pink for this dating app and then like did chalk and spray paint on the cement all around it, totally putting the blame on ourselves. And, you know, it came, you know, it was a big parent company. It comes back to the parent company that this is going to fucking be, you know, it gets viral, obviously, on social media, lots of installs and downloads. I think it equated to about like 30,000 installs of the app, which is worth about $100,000 roughly for a dating app, depending on if it's men or female. Females cost more in dating apps, but to acquire. So let's say it costs $100,000, you know, they still don't want to spend $100,000 on litigation, but it was nothing but like one of the interns worked for the university. So we preemptively put him in to go and like dress up in a suit and go and apologize. And it was not even a slap on the wrist. But that was a literally free thing that they did that they ended up getting paid on. The interns were paid on commission, I think, as well. So it worked out really well. That wasn't necessarily my idea, but I planted the seed that made them think, you know what, this app is going to create value for people. We should just really make this huge. Let's go big, right? So, you know, I think viral marketing should always be a small part of your marketing plan, but it's not the first thing you go to, because you don't want a massive explosion in growth in your product until it's proven out. Start small, reach out to people individually. If you get 100 people that say, yes, we love this product, and they don't have any negative feedback, that's great. Then you go to your large scale potential big partnerships or big opportunities for viral growth or whatever. But you always start small, unless you have huge budgets and you want to get that learning really quickly. You know, I've worked with plenty of projects like that, especially being in San Francisco, where they're like, well, we have more money than we have time. We'd rather accelerate this learning instead of manually reaching out to 100 people. We'd rather put it in front of 10,000 people and get the quantitative feedback that way. So that's another option too. If you're raising money and you're listening to this, I'm Andrew. Please reach out to me.
Love that. Actually reminds me back when I was younger. I was like 12, 13 years old. I'd go skating with my friends in town, and there was this water fountain right next to the cop station. And we would go to, I think it was Chicken Feed at the time, was like one of those $2 stores. I would buy a ton of dishwashing liquid, and we'd just drop the bottles all the way in this fountain. And within an hour or so, the fountain was foamed everywhere. The road was covered in foam and made the front page of the local newspaper.
If only you had something to sell as a 12-year-old, you know what I mean? No, there's
it's funny. I had an interview last week with Zach from Filter Off. They created a dating app, a speed dating video app, and they came out of beta 1st of February this year, just before COVID hit. And of course, COVID hit and the app blew up. They grew 26 times from the 1st of February to like last week when I had him on the show. Phenomenal app, speed dating, all via video. Amazing, amazing, amazing piece of software.
That wouldn't have worked at all if it wasn't for COVID. And I know for a fact from being in the industry that other big companies, which I won't name, have launched video dating apps before. And I know for a fact, again, from being in the industry and talking with those people, that it only didn't work because women didn't want to do video chat. So You know, that's the thing. And, you know, the same thing goes with Jeff Bezos and Amazon and anyone else. You know, it looks like a really stupid idea in 1995. Who gives a shit about books? But he knew that eventually everything will be e-commerce. There is no commerce without e-commerce. So you have to, as an ex-girlfriend of mine used to say, you have to see around the corner before anyone else can see. You know, you have to see through it before they can see around it or something like that.
Mate, so if people are watching this today and they want to get in touch with you and find out maybe the early stages, like right now is a fantastic time to start a business as well.
Absolutely. I think this is the best time in our lifetime because, you know, you have less distraction, less social distraction, less things to do, less clubs, less pubs, whatever. So you have more time to invest in on starting something. And less places to spend your money. So you have more money to invest in the project as well. And I think that's just the good use of the time is for reflection and find and identify a problem that you've got in your life and try and fix that and then solve it for multiple people. If you're at idea stage, start there. If you're past idea stage and you're working on a product and you're about to launch and you don't have really big budgets, you need to do some kind of marketing, do not run to Facebook ads and paid ads. Instead, reach out to me. I would love to coach you on how to do organic marketing. You will actually save much more money learning how to do PR and how to do SEO and how to optimize your app for the App Store yourself. So you can find me at andrewstartups.com. You can email me at me@andrewstartups.com, or you can find me on Instagram at andrewstartups on Instagram. If you're a funded startup and you're already, you know, you've raised money and you're, you know, trying to do marketing yourself, or you are currently spending months trying to hire someone internally, I think it's a terrible time to make a full-time hire. Everybody's working remotely anyway. I have a company called Growth Experts. It's growthexpertswithaz.com. You can check us out there and you can message us and we'd love to put together a proposal for you how we could do your marketing for you.
Outstanding. So Rafi from my team will put the link below this video over on the platform. And if you are an established business right now and maybe you've lost control, maybe looking for a way to kind of get more time back in the business, hire better quality team members, create a more cohesive team, and just essentially create a profitable business that works without you, please click on the link below we put down as well. The book does go on sale the 3rd of August. We're taking pre-release bookings at the moment. Andrew, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate having you on. It was a blast. Time absolutely
flew. Pleasure was mine.
And thank you each and every one of you guys that have joined in either live or in the replay. Please start this live on your newsfeed. Click the bottom right-hand button, start a watch party. Let more people know about the amazing stuff that Andrew shared here today. Appreciate you, brother. See you in the next one.
No, pleasure's all mine. See you, Jim, Greg, and everyone else who commented. Cheers.
Thanks, guys. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Game Changers podcast. There's a couple of things I'd love you to do to help us and help yourself to spread the message further. Make sure that you like the Game Changers on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn. Please subscribe by clicking the link below to ensure that you keep up to date with the weekly episodes we share here at the Game Changers podcast with amazing entrepreneurs and business owners around the world. And of course, like if you're in a position where you may be overwhelmed with business or looking for a way to grow faster and more effectively, and you realize that the key to success is being surrounded by amazing people who have been there and done that before, I'd like to invite you to apply to have a game plan session one-on-one with one of my team here at the Game Changers. There's no cost if you get through. All that we ask is that you are doing a minimum of $250,000 per year to really be able to utilize the strategies and tactics and the mindset shifts that we share with you, that you're coachable, that you're a decent person, and you're willing to take on board some advice. If not, that's totally cool. But I know for me, I wouldn't be where I am right now without the support of so many mentors and coaches and resources along the way. And I'd like to pay that forwards and give back to you the opportunity to work with us one-on-one for free to put together a customized game plan. And the reason we're doing this is a couple of things. Number one is that sometimes it's just the smallest thing that can make the biggest difference. And I think that entrepreneurs and business owners have the opportunity to change the world. And if we can maybe help you to make the smallest shift to change your life and your world, you're changing ours in return. The second thing is that we are always looking for amazing clients to work with and to welcome into and invite into the Game Changers community. And so if at the end of the call, you do feel that there's a huge amount of value there, that we feel that there's a great values fit there, we can have a conversation about working together. But this game plan call, there's absolutely no obligations to work with whatsoever. Allow us to help you with the years and years and years of knowledge that we have in growing and scaling great companies.
companies. And I think that business owners are the future of the world. If there's a way that we can help you to create a better business, more profit, more fulfillment, more fun, I would love the opportunity to do that now. So click the link below, book your game plan session, make sure you follow us on social and stay up to date with the latest episodes of the Game Changers podcast. My name's Barry William-McGinnity. Thank you so much for your support and look forward to seeing you next one. Bye for now.